The following presentation is a production of 63 Audio and the Narada Radio Company, a proud member of the Mutual Audio Network.
Do you dare go down into the cellar? Welcome to The Cellar, Miniseries 4. Starring the Narada Radio Company. And hosted by Kadavra Quivery.
Down, fiends. Stagger over and join Kadavra by the fire. What's that? Oh, I'm just getting caught up on my dead side reading. Yes, I belong to the Spook of the Month Club. They send me a new horror novel every so often. Yes, this one I'm into now is very good. Just chock full of grave characters. Oh, not only that. I heard the author was up for an award, but didn't win, poor thing. Must have been pretty stiff competition. Oh, but enough about this book. You want to hear a creepy story from that other book, don't you? Well, let's go. Follow me, creeps, and we'll find a tale that simply drips with death. Ah. Yes. Huh. Oh, so, my dears, it's high time we paid another visit to haunted Hollywood. Tonight's yarn takes place in the late 30s, and our storyteller is a young man named Milo Mayo, who... Well, at the time of our play, is a public relations man for a major Hollywood film studio. You know the type. A guy who lies for a living. But he swears his tale is 100% true. Oh, ready? Let's listen.
The story I'm about to tell you ain't quite the kind of story that the Hollywood columnists like to print, and it ain't the kind of yarn that press agents like to tell. When I was still working at the public relations department at Optimus Studios, they wouldn't let me break it. And honestly, I knew better than to try, because no paper would have printed such a tale. The name's Mayo, by the way. Milo Mayo. It's the job of Hollywood publicity men to present it as a carefree place, a world of glamour and stardust. We capture the light and gloss over the shadows. But the story I need to tell you, the events of which I speak, tells of a shadow that can't be hidden any longer, that isn't human. That's what caused me to quit Optimus, I guess. I couldn't forget what happened, hard as I'd try. And now, the only way to relieve my mind is to break the story, come what may. Then, perhaps, I can forget Carl Yawler's eyes.
Jesus, I'm exhausted. Well, let's go in here and rest our dogs for a while.
That was Leslie Kincaid, one of the players in this yarn, which dates back to about 3 years ago, in September 1935. She's one of the few lady assistant producers in the film racket these days. She didn't get that way by being ladylike. On this night, in 1935, Leslie and I are slumming down Main Street in L.A., hunting up authentic types to fill minor roles in a gangster picture she's doing. You see, she prefers the genuine article instead of the ready-made imitations provided by the casting office. Well, we've made our way as far as Chinatown without any luck, and the dog tired. Finding ourselves in front of a dingy little burly Q theater, Leslie surprises me by making that crack about going in and resting our dogs. But I follow her in, we buy tickets and find seats. I soon realize that I'm beat too, and could use a nap. After suffering through two striptease dances, an incredibly ancient comedy routine, and a so-called grand finale, the stage darkens and the movie screen comes to life. Now we can get ready for our dose. The pictures shown in these places are usually ancient specimens of the quickie variety, fillers designed to clear the house. I slouch lower in my seat and shut my eyes, getting ready for the Sandman.
Mayo! Mayo!
I'm in dreamland, thank you, don't bother me.
Wake up, Milo, you need to see this.
Will you, for the love of God, lay off with the elbow to my... What?
Are you seeing what I'm seeing?
Jesus, Mary and Joseph. Leslie and I stare, entranced, at the film displayed before us. Both of us have been in the picture business for years, but neither of us have ever seen anything like the spectacle of horror in that moment that meets our eyes.
Judas Priest! What is that crawling out of the grave?
I don't answer her, and she doesn't say another word as the film's story unwinds. Neither do I, for I am completely caught up.
Not a word. We'll talk about it later. I'm going up to grill the theater manager.
What? Who the hell are you? What's the big idea of barging in here?
Mr. Relch, I'm Leslie Kincaid of Optimus Pictures. This is my associate, Mr. Mayo.
And that means what to me? I'm busy here, so get the...
Mr. Relch, we were hoping you could tell us where you acquired the film that was just shown.
That piece of shit returned to the Sabbath? It ain't what I ordered, goddammit. And it's the last time I'll deal with that piece of shit agency out in Inglewood. The rinky-dink bastards. They were supposed to send me a Western picture, and they sent me this goddamn foreign junk by mistake.
Can you tell us the name of the agency?
A hell of a fine picture for a burlicue house. Gave the audience the frickin' creeps, and it wasn't even in frickin' English. Stinkin' imported films.
The name, please, Mr. Relch.
What?
The name of the agency that sent over the stinkin' imported film?
Here. Here's the invoice. Take it. Let him try to collect on that goddamn piece of foreign shit. I ordered a goddamn Western!
5 minutes after we leave the manager's office and establishment, we are squeezed together in a phone booth, and Leslie is on the horn to the film agency that had inadvertently earned the wrath of Edward Relch. Leslie discovers the name of Return to the Sabbath's star, Carl Jorla, who is an Austrian. A few minutes later, we are in my car heading out to the Optimus home office in Burbank. We have an hour's drive ahead of us, and I am eager to talk about what we'd seen now that the initial shock has worn off. Leslie feels the same way. So, did you see what I saw?
Are you pulling my leg?
I would never pull the leg of an assistant producer, no matter how shapely it may be.
Let it go. I mean, wasn't I the one who woke you and told you to watch?
Yeah, and I wish you hadn't. I'll probably have screaming nightmares for weeks. Those eyes.
Exactly. Those eyes. They were... But it started before they appeared, with the bony hands digging themselves out of the grave.
The rest of him was pretty impressive, too. I've never seen a makeup job like that guy had. They're years ahead of us, obviously, in Europe. He was positively cadaverous.
And he seemed to decay as the film wore on, right before our eyes. Oh, by the time they got to the Satan-worshipping scene?
The Black Mass.
Right, the Black Mass. He was positively almost a skeleton, shot full of bullets from the neighbor's guns as he toppled from his seat on the altar stone.
And the way he had to crawl, dragging himself on his belly like a snake until he got to the ritual fire, then dragging himself painfully upright, looking into the flames.
Oh, and then the eyes again. Oh, even though I couldn't understand the words of that incantation he was chanting, well, I knew what he was saying. He wasn't praying to heaven, but to hell. And
the earth opened up in a flash of flame, and the charred corpse fell through. Whew! I've never seen anything like it!
I know. I mean, this is 1935. Hollywood should be the tip of the spear on special effects, but this little film makes our best stuff look like Max Fleischer cartoons.
Well, if you offered to bet me on who's got the better scare factor, I'd put my money on Carl Yorla against Karloff and Lon Chaney. And I'm jaded enough to know when I'm seeing makeup and stand-ins. But I couldn't see where reality ended and the fakery began.
Yeah, the plotline stank.
Stinkaroo!
So trite. Well, we were doing pictures like that in the silent days. But Yorla.
Yeah.
Yorla made it look real. He was dead. His eyes knew. And his voice sounded like... Like Lazarus resurrected.
Like... Lazarus. Leslie, we have to sign Yorla. He's tops. He's better than Lugosi, better than Laurie.
I'm calling Vienna first thing in the morning, after I talk to the boss.
Think you'll sell him on the idea?
Oh, I'll wear him down. Don't you worry.
And she did. Next morning, I am given the go-ahead to start publicizing the announcement that Carl Yorla, the Austrian horror star, has been signed by cable to our studio and is leaving at once for the United States. And I play it up that way. Yorla, Optimus Studios' answer to Universal's Chaney, Karloff, and Lugosi, and Fox's Peter Lorre. I give them all the build-up I can, but after the initial announcements... I was stopped dead.
Milo.
Hiya, boss. How's tricks?
Why do I keep seeing the same stories on this Yorla fella?
It's Yorla, boss. Gee, now we've gone through gallons of ink already, pushing everything we know about him.
Everything? Well, that isn't much, is it?
Well, yeah, right enough. Nah, things have been happening so swift. We honestly don't know very much about Yorla. We've been sending cables to Vienna and to German film studios, but they won't give up anything about his private life.
Were you able to determine if Yorla's been in anything besides this one film, Return to the Sabbath?
Yorla, boss. It's the only one we can find. On top of that, it's had limited release abroad. It was only by accident that the agency in Inglewood got a copy and distributed it here.
Do you have any numbers on audience reaction to the film?
Not a thing. Do you think there's a chance of general release?
No, not without a lot of expensive dubbing into English.
Well, I'm up a stump. Here we got Carl Yorla, the find of the year, and I can't scrape up enough material to make it known.
Well, the man will be here in 2 weeks. You get to work on him as soon as he gets in, and then flood the news agencies with stories. This needs to be big. I've already put 3 of our best writers to work on a special production just for Yorla, with Bleskind directing.
Skip it. Yeah, I heard. I also heard you want to try to recreate that return from the dead scene in the original picture.
We sure do. It's gonna be big. Big, Milo. I'm counting on you, boy. See you later.
Yeah, so long, boss. Yeah.
Hiya, Mr. Mayo. It's Vito, the studio chauffeur.
Hiya, Vito. Have you got him?
Yes, sir. They asked me to call you to let you know we just brung him in from the airport.
Where is he?
Dressing room.
Thanks, Vito. Say, what day is it?
October 7th, Mr. Mayo.
October 7th. Remember this day, Vito.
What? Huh?
Don't ever forget that October 7th was the day that Carl Yorla put Optimus Pictures in the big time. I told the chauffeur not to forget this day. But I never forgot it either. Not the afternoon of our first meeting, nor my first sight of him as I entered his dressing room.
Hello?
Mr. Yawla, it's Milo Mayo from the Public Relations Office. Have you got a minute to talk? I don't know what I expect to see when he opens the door, but what I do see amazes me. For Carl Yawla is the dead alive man of the screen, in life. Tall and almost as cadaverously thin as in his film role, Yawla's face is pallid, and there are dark blue circles under his eyes, and those eyes are the dead eyes, the deep, knowing eyes of the movie. I explain the nature of my visit after he ushers me into his dressing room, but...
No publicity. I do not wish to make known what is affairs of my own doing.
I give him the usual arguments. How much he understands, I can't say, but he's adamant. After a barrage of questions, I am able to learn only a few facts.
In Prague, I am born. My family, in wealth, we live until the terrible depression after the war. So many poor people, the starving. I thought to work in film. I could get a friend I had who was a director. This friend, he make the film which you see. But for a private showing, it was intended only. A small audience, you know. The mistake was opportune for me of the print of being released to the United States, since to leave Austria at once I wish.
Leave Austria? How come?
After the film appear in bad lights, I am with my friends. They do not wish it to be shown, that ceremony.
You mean the Black Mass? What did you say, your friends?
Yes, the worship of Lucifer. It was real, you know.
You're joking, right? But the look on Yawla's face tells me he isn't. No, I can't doubt his sincerity. There is no room for mirth in those strange eyes. And then I know what he meant. He had been a devil worshipper himself. He and the film's director. They had made the film and intended it only for private display in their own occult circles. No wonder he sought escape abroad. Leslie.
Mayo, what brings you around my office?
We're in trouble, kid.
Yawla?
Oh, you said it.
Give.
Okay, but you won't like it. You know how you read in the movie rags about how Boris Karloff is in real life a gentleman who finds peace in raising a garden? How Lugosi is depicted as a sensitive neurotic, tortured by the roles he plays in films. How Peter Lorre is played up as sweet as a lamb, a quiet student whose ambition is to play comedy parts?
Yes, so?
We don't have that kind of story for Yawla.
What do we have?
In real life? A devil worshipper.
Are you pulling my leg? Don't say it. Oh, Christ. No, that'll never do. No, sir. Well, there's always the old Lon Chaney line.
Enlighten me.
Well, you know. Play him up as the mystery man. We'll say nothing about him until the picture is released. After that, I have a hunch things will work out for themselves.
Consequently, I abandon publicity efforts where Carl Yawla is concerned. Now, of course, I'm very glad I do, for there is no one to remember his name or suspect the horror that is soon to follow. The script is soon finished, the sound stage is under construction, the casting director is put to work. Things are buzzing, but it isn't long before our thrill of signing Yawla wears off.
Have you got a drink?
Sure. Bad day?
Bad day, bad week, bad month. Again. What the hell? hell can I do with a man like that? He's either insane or a fool.
Don't tell me. Yorla.
Yorla. Again.
What's going on?
Oh, among other things, trouble with the front office. We found out that he checked out of his hotel a few days after arriving in Hollywood. On top of that, he's giving the director fits. He won't talk about his role, he won't discuss interpretation, and he's confessed to me that the only reason he signed a contract was so he could leave Europe.
What the hell?
Told me the same story he told you. He's part of some cult of devil worshippers, and they're angry at him. He says he's being followed by Avengers who hold him responsible for the release of Return to the Sabbath.
Is that his reason for all the secrecy over where he lives, and why he doesn't want publicity?
I guess so. And the crazy thing is, he honestly believes all of this. I'll tell you the truth. I came over here to see you because of the last thing he mentioned this morning.
Yeah?
Yes. He shows up in my office, wearing dark glasses and a muffler across the lower half of his face. I don't recognize him at first, and then almost don't when he takes them off. Oh, he's changed. Physically. Walks with a stoop and trembles. And his voice, like a groan. And he shows me this.
Wesley hands me a clipping from the London Times. It's a short paragraph that gives an account of the death of Fritz Ullmann, the Austrian film director. He'd been found strangled in a Paris flat, and this body had been severely mutilated. The story describes an inverted cross that has been branded on Ullmann's stomach, above his ripped entrails. Police are seeking the murderer. Okay. So what?
Fritz Ullmann was the director of Return to the Sabbath. He and Yorla knew the devil worshippers. Yorla says Ullmann fled Vienna to Paris, and the Satanists sought him out. It is a mess. I've offered Yorla police protection, and he's refused. Under the terms of his contract, I can't coerce him. As long as he plays his part in the film, he's secure with us, but he's got the jitters. And now I'm getting them. Thanks for the hooch.
Wesley storms out, and I feel bad because I can't help her. I sit there thinking of Carl Yorla, who believed in demons, worshipped, and betrayed them. I could smile at the absurdity of it all. If I hadn't seen the man on the screen and watched his evil eyes, in that moment, I begin to feel thankful that we haven't given him any publicity. I soon hear that Yorla starts coming to the set in a closed car, bundled up to the eyeballs. He's hired two armed men to ride with him in the car. A few days later, I get a call from a reporter on the LA Globe.
You heard about the extra who got arrested after they found an automatic under his vest?
Yeah, happened on Lot 6. What about him?
Well, he's a nutcase, been sent up for observation. He's a German, and he wouldn't talk at first, but eventually he broke. And after he got started babbling, he couldn't stop. Something about his being a member of something called the Black Cult of Lucifer, a secret society of Europeans claiming to worship the devil with vague ties to their mother countries. This guy said he'd been chosen to avenge a wrong. He didn't say what that was, but he did go so far as to divulge an address.
Okay, what about it?
Well, I'm getting to that. The guy said it was a local headquarters for the cult. Cops went out and found it deserted, a rat trap in Glendale. Strangely enough, they found a secret cellar beneath the basement, but the whole place was abandoned. The guy's been fitted for a canvas tuxedo, I tell ya!
I received this report with deep misgivings. Southern California is a mecca for mystics and cultists from all over the world, and Los Angeles has a large heterogeneous foreign population. A guy like me can't be in the business I'm in without hearing rumors about screen stars getting mixed up in unsavory secret societies, things that they'd never dare to admit publicly. And Yorla was afraid. That afternoon, I try to tail his shutted-up black car as it leaves the studio, trying to discover his secret dwelling place. But I lose the track in the winding reaches of Topanga Canyon. That's the night he disappears. At least, he doesn't show up at the studio next morning. With production due to start in 2 days, Leslie Kincaid and the boss are frantic. The morning after that, When Yorla fails to show once more, I go to Leslie and tell her about following his car to Topanga Canyon. The police are called and get to work. Shooting is supposed to start the next morning. Leslie and I spend a sleepless night in a fruitless vigil. Morning comes, and there is an unspoken dread in Leslie's eyes as she faces me across her desk.
What time is it?
8 a.m.
Buy a girl a cup of coffee?
Sure, let's go. As we make our way to the studio commissary for, we hope, some strong coffee, Leslie spots a familiar figure emerging from the Stage 4 office.
Say, that's Bleskind, Yorla's director up ahead. Hey, Bleskind!
Oh, Kincaid, Mayo, I'm tearing my goddamn hair out. Any news?
Uh-uh.
Well, we're shooting today all the same. We'll shoot around Yorla if we have to. If he doesn't show up when we finish the scenes he's not in, we'll get another actor. But we can't wait.
Yeah, no, I don't blame you. Are you headed to the soundstage now?
Yes.
Well, we'll come along with you. I want to see what kind of story you've given him.
Stage 4 is a gothic castle, the ancestral home of Baron Olmo, Yorla's character. A dark, gloomy stone crypt of spidery horror. Cobwebbed, dust-shrouded, deserted by men, and given over to the rats by day and the unearthly horrors that creep by night. An altar stands by the crypt, an altar of evil. The great black stone on which the ancient Baron Olmo and his devil cult had held their sacrifices. Now, in the pit beneath the altar, the first Baron lay buried. Such was the legend. Bleskin's voice, speaking to Sylvia Channing, the ingenue, breaks the spell and turns it back into a soundstage.
All right, Sylvia, honey. We're going to walk through this. Sort of a rehearsal with the cameras rolling, you see?
Yes, Mr. Bleskind.
And I'll be over here giving you direction through the scene, so you know how I want it. Do you follow?
Yes, Mr. Bleskind.
Okay, ready? Yes? Good. Everybody ready? Yes? Good. Quiet on the set. Quiet. Lights. Camera. Give me some music. And action. Okay, Sylvia, you're exploring the castle. You've just inherited it from your dead uncle, the most recent Baron Olmo, okay? Now, in this first scene, you're entering the crypt for the first time and discovering the altar. Good. Good. Now, you see that there's an inscription on the base of the altar, and you say the words out loud.
I don't know if I can say these words, Mr. Bleskind.
Just do your best, honey.
Gabrib, Butosh, Ostida Yuxlab, Kim, you Gotish, Boladi.
Hey, that sounded pretty good to me.
Thanks. I wonder what they mean.
Who knows? Anyway, they're supposed to work as an incantation, see? Now, lights! Bring up the goddamn lights! Now, Sylvia, once you say the incantation, the altar will swing aside, the pit will open, and Baron Olmo will rise from the dead. Can we get the pit open, please? The cameras are going to pan from the pit, opening to your face, okay? And when they do, I want you to give me an expression of abject horror. Can you do it? Yes! Beautiful! Magnificent! It's as if you're watching the resurrected Baron rising from his grave. Wonderful! Okay, Jorla's not here, so we'll cut and take a look at the lighting, and...
Oh! Oh! Mr. Bleskind!
Oh my God. Look!
Something's rising from the crypt!
Quiet! Everybody quiet! Are we still rolling? Okay, let's keep going.
The thing that rises from the crypt is dead. With a mask of faceless flesh, its lean body is clothed in rotting rags, and on its chest is a bloody crucifix. An inverted cross carved into the dead flesh. The eyes blaze with a loathsome fire. It is Baron Olmo rising from the dead. And it is Carl Yorla. Yorla's makeup is perfect. His eyes are dead, just as in the other film. The lips seem shredded, the mouth even more ghastly in its slitted blackness. And the final touch of the bloody inverted cross is genius. Bleskind nearly swallows his cigar when Yorla appears.
Morty, are you getting this? Jim, I want a close-up on Yorla while Morty gets the long shot. Look at Sylvia, she's fainted. I didn't tell her to do that. She must have passed out for real. Brilliant!
Yorla is acting as never before. He moves slowly, as a corpse must move. But every step out of the crypt seems to be causing him utter agony. Sylvia Channing has indeed fainted, and she's lying on her back with her body half bathed in the studio lighting, half in eerie shadow. Now the grisly cadaver is almost half out of the crypt. It strains upward, and its lips are moving. Yorla is giving out a faint, whispering murmur that only seems to heighten the horror. The bloody cross glints redly on his chest, and I remember suddenly the one found on the body of the murdered man in Paris, Fritz Omen, the director, and realize where Yorla had gotten the idea. Sylvia's coming too, trying to sit up as the corpse strains up, trying to rise out of the crypt, up, and then with a sudden spasm, the body stiffens and slides back into the crypt. Who screams first, I don't know, but the screaming continues after the prop boys have rushed to the crypt and looked down at what lay within. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph! The pit! It's completely empty! Later, there's no explanation for what has happened. Neither Yorla's reappearance, nor his even more mysterious re-disappearance. No one had seen him enter the gate. No makeup man had given him his attention. Nobody had seen him enter the crypt. He had appeared in the scene, then disappeared, and the crypt was found empty. These are the facts, and nobody can dispute them.
Bleskind, get that film developed right away. We'll meet in the screening room in 2 hours.
You got it, boss. Leslie, the rushes are ready to roll.
Okay.
Okay, Chet, go ahead. Cut the lights, too.
I heard that two of the film technicians fainted while this print was being developed.
Mayo.
Well, he's not wrong. Okay, now the soundtrack has already been dubbed in. Here's where we begin the scene. There goes Sylvia across the chamber to the altar.
She's reading the incantation.
The crypt is opening.
And out of it comes...
Nobody.
What the hell?
Quiet. Quiet, wait, quiet. Look. There's something on the screen, some small thing. It's red and it's moving. What is it?
It's the inverted cross.
Oh, Christ Almighty.
That's definitely what we see. There is nothing but that great red laceration suspended in midair. The great inverted crucifix cut into bleeding flesh. But no Yorla visible at all. Wait, Leslie, do you hear that? Bleskind, what is that? What's that whispering?
It's an address in Topanga Canyon?
What are you doing?
Calling the cops, sending them to that address. Operator, get me the police. No, not the studio cops, the LAPD.
We wait, the three of us, in Leslie's office. Wait for the return call from the police. She cracks open the bottle of Kentucky bourbon and we drink, but do not speak. I know that each of us is thinking of Carl Yorla, the devil worshipper who had betrayed his faith, of his fear of vengeance, and this disappearance. We think of the director's death and the bloody crucifix on his chest. And then, the ghastly floating reproduction of that inverted cross on the movie screen. The horrid thing that had hung there in midair while Yorla's voice groaned the address. I got it. Yeah. Hi, Lieutenant. What's the word? Yeah, she's here. Uh-huh. What? Oh, Christ. You sure? Gotta go. Thanks. Oh, Christ, I'm gonna be sick. I get the waste paper basket under my mouth in the nick of time, and then I think I fainted because the next thing I know, I am on Leslie's leather couch, and she is dabbing my face with a cool cloth.
Hi, Milo. Can you tell us what the police said?
Yeah. Help me sit up. Thanks. They found Carl Yorla's body at the address he gave on the screen. He was lying dead in an old shack up in the hills, murdered. There was a bloody cross, inverted, carved into his chest. They think it was the work of some fanatics because the place was filled with books on sorcery and black magic. They said...
Go on.
They said that Yorla had been dead for at least 3 days.
Welcome back, fiends. I hope you enjoyed that creepy tale of wicked Tinseltown. Have you ever been to Hollywood? I went there once, just a couple years ago, and swore I'd never go back. Well, I was invited there for a televised poker tournament, but when I arrived, I discovered that they expected me to play cards. And after I'd gone to all the trouble of polishing my best pokers. So I swore I'd never be caught alive in that place. Well, creeps, our play was Return to the Sabbath, adapted for audio by Pete Lutz from a pulp horror story by Robert Bloch, episode 4 of our current miniseries. And I, of course, am your hostly ghost, your ghostly host, Cadaver Quivery. So, until next time, fiends, remember, don't take candy from stranglers.
The Cellar is produced and directed by Pete Lutz. The theme was composed and performed by Tom Rory Parsons. Our cast consisted of the following players: Andy Hartson-Bowyer as Milo Mayo, Rhiannon McAfee as Leslie Kincaid, David Ian as Edward Relch, Nick Womack as the studio boss, Austin Beach as Bleskind, George Hatfield as Vito, Tom Conkle as Carl Yorla, Dana Gonzalez as the reporter, and Carol Cron as Sylvia Channing. Cadavra Quivery is played by Angela Young. Additional music was by Dr. Ross Bernhardt. This is Trevor Rhine speaking. The Cellar is a 63 audio production, mixed and mastered in Corpus Christi, Texas. Join us next time when Cadavera presents miniseries 4 finale. we meet up with a set of twins who have unusual stories to tell after a near-death experience about what they saw on the other side. That's Twin Peaks, next time in The Cellar.
Yeah, 63 Audio.
This is Mutual.